lightly in butter. The yeasty odor of baking bread dough.
And you can't smell the turkey yet, Faye said. Ned just put that in the oven half an hour ago.
He says dinner's at 8, Ernie told him. But I suspect the odors will drive us mad and force us to storm the kitchen before then.
Faye said, Learn anything at the Sentinel?
Before Ginger could tell them what she and Dom had uncovered, the front door of the motel office opened, and a slightly pudgy man entered in a burst of cold, whirling wind. He had hurried from his car without bothering to put on a topcoat. Although he wore gray slacks, a dark blue blazer, a light blue sweater, and an ordinary white shirt rather than a black suit and a Roman collar, his identity was not for a moment in doubt. He was the auburn-haired, green-eyed, round-faced young priest in the Polaroid snapshot that the unknown correspondent had sent to Dom.
Father Cronin, Ginger said.
She was as immediately and powerfully drawn to him as she had been to Dominic Corvaces. With the priest, as with Dom, Ginger sensed a shared experience even more shattering than the one which she had shared with the Blocks and Sarvers. Within the event that they had all witnessed that Friday in July, there had been a second event experienced by only some of them. Although it was a frightfully improper way to greet a man who was a virtual stranger and a priest, Ginger rushed to Father Cronin and threw her arms around him. But apologies were not required, for Father Cronin evidently sensed the same thing she did. Without hesitation, he returned her hug, and for a moment they clung to each other, not as if they were strangers, but brother and sister, greeting each other after a long separation. Then Ginger stepped back, as Dom said, Father Cronin, and came forward to embrace the priest.
There's no need to call me Father. At the moment, I neither want nor deserve to be considered a priest. Please, just call me Brandon.
Ernie shouted upstairs to Ned and Sandy, then followed Faye out from behind the check-in counter. Brandon shook Ernie's hand and embraced Faye, obviously feeling great affection for them, though not a closeness as powerful and inexplicable as the tremendous emotional magnetism that pulled him toward Dom and Ginger. When Ned and Sandy came downstairs, he greeted them the same as he had Ernie and Faye. Just as Ginger had done last night, Brendan said,
I have a truly wonderful sense of being among family. You all feel it, don't you? As if we've shared the most important moments of our lives, went through something that'll always make us different from everyone else?
In spite of his insistence that he did not deserve the deference accorded a priest, Brendan Cronin had a profoundly spiritual air about him. His somewhat pudgy face, sparkling eyes, and broad, warm smile conveyed joy, and he moved among them, touched them, and spoke with an ebullience that was infectious and that somehow lifted Ginger's soul. Brendan said,
What I feel in this room only reassures me that I've made the right decision in coming. I'm meant to be with you. Something will happen here that will transform us, that's already begun to transform us. Do you feel it? Do you feel it?
The priest's soft voice sent a pleasant shiver up Ginger's spine, filled her with an indescribable sense of wonder reminiscent of what she'd felt the first time that, as a medical student, she had stood in an operating room and had seen a patient's thorax held open by surgical retractors to reveal the pulsing, mysterious complexity of the human heart in all its crimson grandeur.
Called, Brendan said.
The softly spoken word echoed eerily around the room.
All of us called back to this place.
Look, Dom said,
packing a paragraph of amazement into that one syllable, raising his arms and holding his hands out to show them the red rings of swollen flesh that had appeared in his palms. Surprised, Brendan raised his hands, which were also branded by the strange stigmata. As the men faced each other, the air thickened with unknown power. Yesterday, on the telephone, Father Vikazic had told Dom that Brendan was relatively certain no religious element was involved in the miraculous cures and other events that had recently transformed the young priest's life, Yet the motel office seemed to Ginger to be filled with a force that, if not supernatural, was certainly beyond the ken of any man or woman.
"Called," Brendan said again.
Ginger was gripped by breathless expectancy. She looked at Ernie, who stood behind Faye with his hands on her shoulders, and both their faces were full of tremulous suspense. Ned and Sandy, who were by the rack of postcards holding hands, were wide-eyed. Ginger felt the flesh prickling on the back of her neck. She thought, something's going to happen. And even as the thought took form, something did. Every lamp in the motel office was aglow in deference to Ernie's uneasiness in the presence of deep shadows. But abruptly, the place was even brighter than it had been. A milky white light filled the room, springing magically from molecules of air. It shimmered on all sides, but rained mostly from overhead, a silvery mist of luminosity. She realized this was the same light that featured in her unremembered lunar dreams. She turned in a circle, looking around and up through spangled curtains of brilliant yet soft radiance, not in search of the source, but with the hope of remembering her dreams and ultimately the events of that long-lost summer night that had inspired the dreams. Ginger saw Sandy reach into the glowing air with one hand, as if to grasp a fistful of the miraculous light. A tentative smile pulled at Ned's mouth. Faye smiled, too, and Ernie's expression of childlike wonder was almost laughably out of place on his ruggedly hewn face.
"The moon," Ernie said.
"The moon," Dom echoed, the stigmata still blazing on his hands. For one thrilling moment, Ginger Weiss was poised on the brink of complete understanding. The black, blank membrane of her memory block trembled. Revelation pressed strenuously against the far side, and that membrane seemed certain to split and spill forth everything that had been dammed beyond it. Then the light changed from moon white to blood red, and with it, the mood changed from wonder and growing delight to fear. She no longer sought revelation but dreaded it, no longer welcomed understanding but withdrew from it in terror and revulsion. Ginger stumbled back through the bloody glow, bumped against the front door. Across the room, beyond Dom and Brendan, Sandy Sarver had ceased reaching up to seize a handful of light. She was holding tightly to Ned, whose smile had become a rictus of repulsion. Faye and Ernie were pressing back against the check-in counter. As scarlet incandescence welled like fluid into the room and filled it from corner to corner, the stunning visual phenomena were augmented by sound. Ginger jumped in surprise as a loud three-part crash shook the sanguineous air, jumped once more as it repeated, then flinched, but did not jump when it came again. It had a cardiac quality, like the thunderous beating of a great heart, though it featured one more stroke than a usual heartbeat. Lub-dub-dub. 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 She knew at once that it was the apparitional noise of which Father Vekazik had spoken in his telephone conversation with Dom, the noise that had arisen in Brendan Cronin's bedroom and had shaken St. Bernadette's. But she also knew that she had heard this very thing before. This entire display, the moon-like light, the blood-red radiance, the noise was part of something that had happened the summer before last. Lub-dub-dub. Lub-dub-dub. The window frames rattled, the walls shook, the bloody light and the lamplight began to pulse in time with the pounding. Lub-dub-dub. Lub-dub-dub. Again, Ginger was approaching a shocking recollection. With each crash of sound and throb of light, long-buried memory surged nearer. However, her inhibiting fear grew. A towering black wave of terror bore down on her. The Azrael block was doing what it was designed to do. Rather than let remembrance have its way with her, she would plunge into a fugue state, as she had not done since the day Pablo Jackson had been killed 1 week ago.
The familiar signs of oncoming blackout were present. She was having difficulty breathing. She trembled with a sense of mortal danger so strong it was palpable. The world around her began to fade. An oily darkness seeped in at the edges of her vision. Run or die! Ginger turned her back on the phenomenal events transpiring in the office. With both hands, she gripped the frame of the front door as if to anchor herself to consciousness and thwart the black wave that sought to sweep her away. In desperation, she looked through the glass at the vast Nevada landscape, at the somber winter sky, trying to block out the stimuli, the impossible light and sound that pushed her toward a dark fugue. Terror and mindless panic grew so unbearable that escape into a hateful fugue seemed almost preferable, yet she somehow held fast to the doorframe, held tight, held on, shaking and gasping, held on, terrified not so much by the strange events occurring behind her, but by the unremembered events of that summer, of which these phenomena were only dim echoes, and still she held on, until the three-stroke thunder faded, until the red light paled, until the room was silent, and until the only light was that coming through the windows or from ordinary lighting fixtures. She was all right now. She was not going to black out. For the first time, she had successfully resisted a seizure. Maybe her ordeal of the past few months had toughened her. Maybe just being here, within reach of all the answers to the mystery, had given her the heart to resist. Or maybe she had drawn strength from her new family. Whatever the reason, she was confident that, having once fended off a fugue, she would find it easier to deal with future attacks. Her memory blocks were crumbling, and her fear of facing up to what had happened that July 6th was now far outweighed by the fear of never knowing. Shaky, Ginger turned toward the others again. Brendan Cronin tottered to the sofa and sat, trembling visibly. The rings were no longer visible in either his hands or Dom's. To the priest, Ernie said,
"Did I understand you? That same light sometimes fills your room at night?"
"Yes," Brendan acknowledged. "Twice before. But you told us it was a lovely light," Faye said.
"Yeah," Ned agreed. "You made it sound wonderful."
"It is," Brendan said. "Partly it is. But when it turns red, well, then it scares the hell out of me. But when it first starts, oh, it uplifts me and fills me with the strangest joy."
The ominous scarlet light and the frightening three-part hammering had generated such terror in Ginger that she had temporarily forgotten the exhilarating moon-white glow that had preceded it and that had filled her with wonder. Wiping his palms on his shirt, as if the vanished rings had left an unwanted residue upon his hands, Dom said, "There was both a good and evil aspect to the events of that night. We long to relive a part of what happened to us, yet at the same time it scares us.
Scares us. Scares us shitless," Ernie said.
Ginger noticed that even Sandy Sarver, who heretofore had perceived only a benign shape to the mystery, was frowning. When Georgia Monotella buried her ex-husband, Alan Rykoff, at 11 o'clock Monday morning, the Las Vegas sun beamed down between scattered iron-gray clouds. 100 shafts of golden sunshine, some half a mile across, some only a few yards wide, like cosmic spotlights, left many buildings in winter shadows while highlighting others. Several shafts of sunshine moved across the cemetery, harried by the rushing clouds, sweeping eastward across the barren floor of the desert. As the portly funeral director concluded a non-denominational prayer, as the casket was lowered into the waiting grave, a particularly bright beam illuminated the scene, and color burst from the flowers. In addition to Georgia and Paul Rykoff, Alan's father, who had flown in from Florida, Only 5 people had shown up. Even George's parents had not come. By his selfishness, Alan had assured an exit from life accompanied by a minimum of grieving. Paul Rykoff, too like his son in some respects, blamed Georgia for everything. He had been barely civil since his arrival yesterday. Now that his only child was in the ground, he turned from Georgia, stone-faced, and she knew she would meet him again only if his stubbornness and anger eventually were outweighed by a desire to see his grandchild. She drove only a mile before she pulled to the side of the road, stopped, and finally wept. She wept neither for Alan's suffering nor for the loss of him, but for the final destruction of all the hope with which their relationship had begun, the burnt-out hopes for love, family, friendship, mutual goals, and shared lives. She had not wished Alan dead. But now that he was dead, she knew it would be easier to make the new beginning toward which she had been planning and working, and that realization made her feel neither guilty nor cruel. It was just sad. Last night, Georgia told Marcy her father was dead, though not that he'd committed suicide. Initially, Georgia had not intended to tell her until this afternoon, in the presence of Dr. Coverley, the psychologist. But the appointment with Coverley had to be canceled because later today, Georgia and Marcy were flying to Elko to join Dominic Corvaces, Ginger Weiss, and the others. Marcy took the news of Alan's death surprisingly well. She cried, but not hard or long. At 7, she was old enough to understand death, but still too young to grasp the cruel finality of it. Besides, by his abandonment of Marcy, Alan unwittingly had done the girl a favor. In a sense, for her he had died more than a year ago, and her mourning had already been done. One other thing had helped Marcy overcome her grief, her obsession with the collection of moon pictures. Only an hour after she learned of her father's death, the child was sitting at the dining room table, eyes dry, small pink tongue poked between her teeth in total concentration, a crayon stub in one hand. She had begun the moon coloring project on Friday evening and pursued it through the weekend. By breakfast this morning, every one of the photographs and all but 50 of the hundreds of hand-drawn moons had been transformed into fiery globes. Marcy's obsession would have disturbed Georgia even if she had not known others shared it, and that two had killed themselves. The moon was not yet the focus of the girl's every waking hour. However, Georgia required little imagination to see that if the obsession progressed, Marcy might travel irretrievably into the land of madness. Her anxiety about Marcy was so acute that she quickly overcame the tears that had forced her to pull to the side of the road. She put the Chevette in gear and drove to her parents' house, where Marcy waited. The girl was at the kitchen table with the ubiquitous album of moons, applying a scarlet crayon. She glanced up when Georgia arrived, smiled weakly, and returned at once to the task before her. Pete, Georgia's father, was also at the table, frowning at Marcy. Occasionally, he thought of a stratagem to interest her in some activity less bizarre and more wholesome than the endless coloring of moons. But all his attempts to lure her away from the album failed. In her parents' bedroom, Georgia changed from her dress into jeans and a sweater for the trip north, while Mary Monotella badgered her.
"When will you take that book away from Marcy? Or let me take it away?"
"Mother, I told you before. Dr. Coverley believes taking the book from her right now would only reinforce her obsession. That doesn't make any sense to me," Georgia's mother said.
"Dr. Coverley says if we make an issue of the moon collection at this early stage, we'll be emphasizing its importance and..."
"Nonsense! Does this Coverley have kids of his own?"
"I don't know, Mom."
"I'll bet he doesn't have kids of his own. If he did, he wouldn't be giving you such dumb advice."
Having put her dress on a hanger, having stripped down to bra and panties, Georgia felt naked and vulnerable, for this situation reminded her of when her mother used to watch her dress for dates with boys who did not meet approval. No boy,
ever met Mary's approval. In fact, Georgia married Alan in part because Mary disapproved of him. Matrimony as rebellion. Stupid, but she had done it and paid dearly. Mary had driven her to it, Mary's suffocating and authoritarian brand of love. Now Georgia grabbed the jeans that were laid out on the bed and slipped into them, dressing fast. Mary said,
"She won't even say why she's collecting those things." "Because she doesn't know why. It's a compulsion, an irrational obsession. And if there's a reason for it, the reason is buried down in her subconscious where even she can't get a look at it."
Mary said, "That book should be taken away from her."
"Eventually," Georgia said. "One step at a time, Mom."
"If it was up to me, I'd do it right now." Georgia had packed two big suitcases and had left them here earlier. Now, when it was time to go to the airport, Pete drove, and Mary went along for the opportunity to engage in more nagging. Georgia and Marcy shared the back seat. On the way to the airport, the girl paged continuously, silently, back and forth through her album. Between Georgia and Mary, the subject of conversation had changed from the best way to deal with Marcy's obsession to the imminent trip to Elko. Mary had doubts about this expedition and did not hesitate to express them. Was the plane just a 12-seater? Wasn't it dangerous to go up in a bucket of bolts owned by a small-time outfit that was probably short of cash and skimped on maintenance? What was the purpose of going, anyway? Even if some people in Elko were having problems like Marcy's, how could it possibly have anything to do with the fact that they'd all stayed at the same motel?
"This Curvaceous guy bothers me," Pete said as he braked for a red traffic light. "I don't like you getting involved with his kind."
"What do you mean? You don't even know him."
"I know enough," Pete said. "He's a writer, and you know what they're like. I read once that Norman Mailer hung his wife out a high window by her heels. And isn't it Hemingway who's always getting into fistfights?"
Georgia said, "Daddy, Hemingway's dead."
"See? I was getting in fights, drunk, using drugs. Writers are a flaky bunch. I don't like you being involved with writers."
"This trip is a big mistake," Mary said flatly.
It never ended. At the airport, when she kissed them goodbye, they told her they loved her, and she told them the same. And the strange thing was that they were all telling the truth. Though they continuously sniped at her, and though she had been deeply wounded by their sniping, they loved one another. Without love, they would have stopped speaking long ago. The parent-child relationship was sometimes even more perplexing than the mystery of what had happened at the Tranquility Motel 2 summers ago. The feeder line's bucket of bolts was more comfortable than Mary would have believed, with 6 well-padded seats on each side of a narrow aisle, free headphones providing bland but mellowing Muzak tapes, and a pilot who handled his craft as gently as a new mother carried her baby. 30 minutes out of Las Vegas, Marcy closed the album and, in spite of the daylight streaming through the portholes, she drifted off to sleep, lulled by the loud but hypnotic droning of the engines. During the flight, Georgia thought about her future, the business degree toward which she was working, her hope of owning a dress shop, the hard work ahead, and loneliness, which was already a problem for her. She wanted a man. Not sexually, although that would be welcome, too. She had dated a few times since the divorce, but had been to bed with no one. She was no female eunuch. Sex was important to her, and she missed it, but sex was not the main reason she wanted a man. One special man. A mate. She needed someone to share her dreams, triumphs and failures. She had Marcy, but that was not the same. The human species seemed genetically compelled to make life's journey 2 by 2, and the need was particularly strong in Georgia. As the plane droned north-northeast, Georgia listened to Mantovani on the headphones and indulged in a bit of uncharacteristic, girlish fantasizing. At the Tranquility Motel, perhaps she would meet a special man with whom she could share this new beginning.
She recalled Dominic Corvaces's gentle but confident voice and included him in her fantasy. If Corvaces was the one for her, imagine what her father would say when he learned she was marrying one of those flaky, drunken writers who held their wives by the heels and dangled them out high windows. She scrapped that particular fantasy soon after the plane landed, for she quickly perceived that Corvaces's heart was already claimed. At 4:30 in Elko, half an hour before sunset, the sky was plated with dark clouds, and the Ruby Mountains were purple-black on the horizon. A penetratingly cold wind, sweeping in from the west, was ample proof that they had come 400 miles north from Las Vegas. Corvaces and Dr. Ginger Weiss were waiting on the tarmac beside the small terminal, and the moment that Georgia saw them, she had the odd but reassuring feeling that she was among family. That sensation was something of which Corvaces had spoken on the phone, but Georgia had not understood what he meant until she experienced it, and it was quite separate from the feelings she had for Ginger as her roadside savior. Even Marcy, bundled in coat and scarf, her eyes still puffy from the nap on the plane, the album clutched to her chest, was stirred from her moody, trance-like state by the sight of the writer and the physician. She smiled and answered their questions with more enthusiasm than had marked her speech in days. She offered to show them her album, and she submitted with a giggle when Corvaces scooped her up in his arms to carry her to the parking lot. "We were right to come," Georgia thought. "Thank God we did." Carrying Marcy, Corvaces led the way to the car while Georgia and Ginger followed with the suitcases. As they walked, Georgia said,
"Maybe you don't remember, but you provided emergency treatment for Marcy that Friday evening in July, even before we checked into the Tranquility."
The physician blinked.
"In fact, I hadn't remembered. Was that you and your late husband? Was that Marcy? But of course it was."
"We had parked along I-80, 5 miles west of the motel," Georgia recalled. "The view to the south was so spectacular. Such a wonderful panorama that we wanted to use it as a backdrop for some snapshots." Ginger nodded.
"And I was driving east in your wake. I saw you up ahead, parked along the shoulder. You were focusing the camera. Your husband and Marcy had stepped over the guardrail and were standing a few feet farther out, posing at the edge of the highway embankment. I didn't want them standing so close to the brink, but Alan insisted it was the best position for the best picture. And when Alan insisted on something, there was no use arguing with him."
However, before Georgia had been able to click the shutter, Marcy had slipped and fallen backward over the edge, tumbling down the 30- or 40-foot embankment. Georgia screamed. Marcy flung the camera aside, vaulted the guardrail, and started down toward her daughter. Fast as she was, however, Georgia had just reached Marcy when she heard someone shouting,
"Don't move her! I'm a doctor!"
That had been Ginger Weiss, and she had descended the slope so rapidly that she had arrived at Marcy's side simultaneously with Alan, who had started down before her. Marcy was still and silent, but not unconscious, only stunned, and Ginger quickly determined that the girl had not sustained a head injury. Marcy began to cry, and because her left leg was tucked under her at a somewhat odd angle, Georgia was certain it was broken. Ginger was able to allay that fear, too. In the end, because the slope was rock-free and cushioned by bunch grass, Marcy came through with only minor injuries, a few scrapes and bruises.
"I was so impressed by you," Georgia said.
"Me?" Ginger looked surprised. She waited for an incoming single-engine plane to pass overhead, then,
"I did nothing special, you know. I only examined Marcy. She didn't need heroic care, just band-aids."
As they put the suitcases in the trunk of Dom's car, Georgia said,
"Well, I was impressed. You were young, pretty, feminine, yet you were a doctor, efficient, quick-thinking. I'd always thought of myself as a born cocktail waitress, nothing more, but that encounter with you started a fire in me. Later, when Alan walked out on us, I didn't fall apart. I remembered you, and I decided to make more of myself than I'd ever thought I could. In a way,
You changed my life.
Closing the trunk lid, locking it, handing the keys to Dom, who had already put Marcy in the car, Ginger said,
Georgia, I'm flattered, but you're giving me much too much credit. You changed your own life.
It wasn't what you did that day, Georgia said. It's what you were. You were exactly the role model I needed.
Embarrassed, the physician said,
Good God! No one's ever called me a role model before. Oh, honey, you're definitely unbalanced.
Ignore her, Dom told Georgia. She's the best role model I've ever seen. Her humble mutterings are pure schmonces.
Ginger Weiss whirled on him, laughing.
Schmonces?
Dom grinned.
I'm a writer, so it's my job to listen and absorb. I hear a good expression, I use it. Can't fault me for doing my job.
Schmonces, huh?
Ginger Weiss said, pretending anger.
Still grinning, the writer said, Eh, if the Yiddish fits, wear it.
That was the moment when Georgia knew Dominic Corvaces' heart was already claimed, and that she would have to exclude him from any romantic fantasy she might cook up in the future. The spark of desire and glimmer of deep affection shone brightly in his eyes when he looked at Ginger Weiss. The same heat warmed the physician's gaze. The funny thing was, neither Dom nor Ginger appeared quite to realize the true power of their feelings for each other. Not quite yet, but soon. They drove out of Elko toward the Tranquility, 30 miles to the west. As twilight faded toward night in the east, Dom and Ginger told Georgia what had happened prior to her and Marcy's arrival. Georgia found it increasingly difficult to hold the good mood she'd been in since stepping off the plane. As they sped through the gloom-mantled barrens, with craggy and threatening black mountains thrusting up at the horizon under a blood-dark sky, Georgia wondered if this place was, as she had thought, the threshold of a new beginning, or a doorway to the grave. After the Lear landed in Salt Lake City, Utah, Jack Twist quickly transferred to a chartered Cessna Turbo Skylane RG, piloted by a polite but tight-lipped man with a huge handlebar mustache. They arrived in Elko, Nevada at 4:53, in the last light of day. The airport was too small to have Hertz and Avis counters, but a local entrepreneur operated a modest little taxi company. Jack had the cab take him and his three big suitcases to a local Jeep dealership where they were getting ready to close, and where he startled the salesman by paying cash for a four-wheel drive Cherokee wagon. To this point, Jack took no evasive action to shake off a tail or even to determine if he had one. His adversaries clearly possessed great power and resources, and regardless of how frantically he tried to elude them, they would have sufficient manpower to keep tabs on a lone target trying to escape on foot or by taxi in a town as small as Elko. Once the Cherokee was his, Jack drove away from the dealership, and for the first time he looked for a tail. He glanced repeatedly at the rearview and side mirrors, but he spotted no suspicious vehicles. He went directly to an Arco mini-mart that he had noticed during the taxi ride from the airport. He parked at the dark end of the lot, beyond the reach of the arc lamps, got out of the wagon and surveyed the shadowy street behind for an indication of a pursuer. He saw no one. That didn't mean they weren't out there. In the mini-mart, the blindingly excessive fluorescent lighting and chrome display fixtures made him long for the good old days of quaint corner groceries operated by immigrant couples who spoke with appealing accents, where the air would have been redolent of Mama's homemade baked goods and Papa's made-to-order deli sandwiches. Here, the only aromas were a vague trace of disinfectant and the thin odor of ozone coming off the motors of refrigerated display cases. Squinting in the glare, Jack bought a map of the county, a flashlight, a quart of milk, 2 packages of dried beef, a little box of small chocolate donuts, and, on a morbid impulse, something called a hamwich, which was a guaranteed delicious one-piece sandwich of pulverized, blended, remolded ham, paste, bread, and spices, and which was claimed to be especially convenient for hikers, campers, and sportsmen.
ham paste. At the bottom of the airtight plastic package was this legend. Real meat. Jack laughed. They had to tell you it was real meat, because even though it was wrapped in clear plastic, you couldn't tell what the hell it was by looking at it. Yes, sir, oh, yes. Ham paste and real meat. That was why he had gone to Central America to fight for his country. He wished Jenny were alive and here with him. Real meat, as opposed to fake polyester meat. She'd have gotten a kick out of that. When he walked out of the mini-mart, he paused to study the street again, but again he saw no one suspicious. He returned to the Cherokee at the dark end of the lot and put up the tailgate. He opened one of his suitcases, withdrew an empty nylon rucksack, the Beretta, a loaded clip, a box of .32 ammunition, and one of the pipe-type silencers. As his breath steamed from him in the cold air, he transferred the groceries from the paper bag to the rucksack. He screwed the silencer onto the gun, slammed the loaded clip into the butt. When he had distributed all the loose ammunition among the many pockets of his heavily insulated leather jacket, he closed the tailgate. Behind the wheel of the Cherokee once more, Jack put the Beretta on the seat beside him and set the rucksack on top of it for concealment. Using the new flashlight, he passed a few minutes studying the map of Elko County. When he switched the flashlight off and put the map away, he was ready to engage the enemy. For the next 5 minutes, he drove through Elko, using every trick he knew to reveal a tail, staying on quiet residential streets where traffic was light and where a surveillance team would be as obvious as a festering cold sore, no matter how good they were. Nothing. He parked at the end of a cul-de-sac and got an anti-surveillance broadband receiver from one of the suitcases. This device, the size of 2 packs of cigarettes, with a short antenna that telescoped out of the top, received all possible radio bands from 30 to 120, including FM from 88 to 108. If a transmitter had been fixed to the Jeep while he was in the market, enabling a tail to follow at a distance, his broadband receiver would pick up the signals. A feedback loop would cause the receiver to emit an ear-piercing squeal. He pointed the antenna at the Jeep and slowly circled the vehicle. The Cherokee had not been bugged. He put the broadband receiver away and got behind the wheel of the wagon again, where he sat for a minute in thought. He was under neither visual nor electronic surveillance. Did that make sense? When his adversaries put those Tranquility Motel postcards in his safe deposit boxes, they must have known he would come to Nevada at once. Surely they also knew that he was a potentially dangerous man. And surely they would not allow him to plot against them on their own turf, unobserved. Yet that seemed to be precisely what they were doing. Frowning, Jack twisted the key in the ignition. The engine roared. On the Lear from New York, he had pondered the situation at length and had arrived at several theories, most of them half-baked, as to the identity and intentions of his adversaries. Now, he decided that nothing he dreamed up was half as strange as whatever was actually happening. No one was watching. That spooked him. The inexplicable always spooked him. When you couldn't understand a situation, that usually meant you were missing something important. If you were missing something important, that meant you had a blind side. If you had a blind side, you could get your ass shot off when you were least expecting it. Alert, cautious, Jack Twist drove north from Elko on State Route 51. After a while, he turned west, following a series of gravel and dirt tracks, sneaking behind the Tranquility Motel instead of making an open approach on I-80. Eventually, he was reduced to traveling overland on sometimes dangerous terrain, from an elevation as high as 4,000 feet down across sloping foothills toward the plains. When the clouds parted, revealing a three-quarter moon, he switched off the headlights and continued, guided only by the glow of the lunar lamp, and his eyes soon adjusted to the night.
Jack topped a rise and saw the Tranquility Motel, a lonely group of lights in a vast, dark emptiness, a mile and a half below and southwest of him, this side of I-80. There were not as many lights as there ought to have been. Either the place had little business, or it was not open. He did not want to advertise his arrival, so he would proceed on foot. He left the Beretta in the Jeep and took the Uzi submachine gun. Actually, he did not expect trouble, not yet. His adversaries, whoever the hell they were, had not teased him into coming all this way merely to kill him. They could have killed him in New York if that was all they wanted. Nevertheless, he was prepared for violence. In addition to the Uzi and a spare magazine, he took the rucksack of groceries, a battery-powered directional microphone, and a StarTron night vision device. He pulled on gloves and a toboggan cap. Jack found the hike invigorating. The night was cold, and when the wind gusted, it stung, but not unpleasantly. Because he had expected to go to ground immediately upon arrival in Nevada, he had dressed suitably when he left New York. He wore high-topped hiking shoes with hard rubber soles and heavy tread, long johns and jeans, a sweater, and a leather jacket with a thick, quilted lining. The crew of the chartered Lear was surprised by his appearance, but they treated him as if he were in tuxedo and top hat. Even an ugly man with one cast eye, dressed like an ordinary laborer, elicited respect when he could afford to lease a private jet rather than fly commercial airlines. Now Jack walked. Ragged tears in the clouds disrobed the moon, and the few widely scattered patches of snow shone brightly, as if they were shards of bone glimpsed in the darker carcass of the hump-backed hills. The bare earth, rock formations, sagebrush, and plentiful dry grass accepted the caress of moonlight and were limned in a vague, milky blonde hue. But when the moon slipped behind the clouds, deep, rich darkness flooded forth. At last he reached a suitable observation point on the southern slope of a hill, only a quarter of a mile behind the Tranquility Motel. He sat down, putting the Uzi and his rucksack aside. The StarTron night vision device took available light, starlight, moonlight, the natural phosphorescence of snow and of certain plants, meager electric light, if any, and amplified it 85,000 times. With the gadget's single lens, Jack could transform all but the very blackest nights into gray daylight, or better. He propped his elbows on his knees, held the StarTron in both hands, and focused on the Tranquility. The rear of the structure popped into view with sufficient clarity for him to determine that no lookouts were posted in any shadowed niches. None of the motel units had windows along the back wall, so no guards could be watching from those rooms. The center third of the motel had a second floor, probably the owner's apartment, and light shone at most of those windows. However, he could not see into the apartment because the drapes and blinds were drawn. He put the StarTron in the rucksack and picked up the battery-powered, handheld directional microphone, which resembled a futuristic gun. Only a few years ago, rifle mics were effective to a distance of only 200 yards, but these days, a good, power-amplified unit could suck in a conversation up to a quarter of a mile, much farther if conditions were ideal. The device included a pair of compact earphones, which he put on. He aimed the mic at a window shielded by drapes, and at once heard animated voices. However, he got only scraps of their conversation because he was trying to pull their voices out of a closed room and through a quarter mile of blustery wind. With great caution, he grabbed the Uzi and other gear and moved closer, choosing a second observation point less than 100 yards from the building. When he aimed the mic at the window again, he picked up every word spoken beyond the glass, in spite of the muffling draperies. He heard 6 voices, maybe more. They were eating dinner and complimenting the cook, someone named Ned, and his helper, Sandy, on the turkey, the pecan stuffing, and other dishes. "They're not just eating dinner," Jack thought enviously. "They're having a damned banquet in there."
He had eaten a light lunch on the Lear, but had taken nothing since. He was still on Eastern Standard Time, so for him it was almost 11 o'clock. He would probably be eavesdropping for hours, piecing together these people's identities, gradually determining if they were his adversaries. He was too hungry to wait that long for his own dinner, such as it was. With a few rocks, he made a brace for the microphone to keep it angled toward the window. He unwrapped the hamwich and bit into that pulverized, blended, and remolded treat. It tasted like sawdust soaked in rancid bacon fat. He spat out the gummy mouthful and settled down to a meager meal of dried beef and doughnuts, which would have been more satisfying if he had not had to listen to those strangers indulging in a modern version of a harvest feast. Soon, Jack had heard enough of the conversation in the apartment to know these people were not his enemies. Strangely, one way or another, they had been drawn or summoned here, as he had been. Monitoring them, he began to think their voices were curiously familiar, and he was overcome with the feeling that he belonged among them as a brother among family. A woman named Ginger and a man, either Don or Dom, began to tell the others about research they had done earlier in the offices of the Elko Sentinel. Listening to talk of toxic spills, roadblocks, and highly trained Dero troops, Jack felt his appetite fading. Dero? Shit! He'd heard about the Dero companies, though they'd been formed after he'd left the service. They were gung-ho types who'd happily accept an order to go into a pit against a grizzly bear armed only with a meat grinder, and they were tough enough to make sausages out of the bear. Forced to choose between a quick, painless suicide and hand-to-hand combat with a Dero, the ordinary man would be well advised to blow his own brains out and save himself pain. Jack realized he was involved in something far bigger and more dangerous than Fratellanza revenge or any of the other things he had hypothesized during his flight from New York. Although the picture he got from eavesdropping was full of holes, he began to grasp that these people had come together to discover what had happened to them the summer before last, the same weekend Jack had stayed here. They had made considerable headway in their investigation, and Jack winced as they openly discussed their progress. They were so naive that they thought closed doors and covered windows ensured privacy. He wanted to shout, "Hey, for God's sake, shut up already. If I can hear you, they can hear you." Dero. That bit of news made him even sicker than the hamwich. In the motel, they continued to chatter, revealing their strategy to the enemy even as they worked it out. And at last, Jack tore off the earphones, frantically grabbed his guns and equipment, and hurried down through the darkness toward the Tranquility Motel. The apartment had no dining room, just the alcove and the kitchen, but that area was too small to seat nine. In the living room, they moved the furniture against the walls, brought in the kitchen table, and used both extra leaves to extend it, accommodating everyone. To Dom, the impromptu arrangements contributed to the feeling of a family gathering and to the mood of cautious festivity. Rather than have to repeat themselves, Dom and Ginger had waited until dinner, when the group was gathered, to report on their research at the newspaper in Elko. Now, over the clinking of silverware, they revealed that the Army had blockaded I-80 minutes before the toxic spill that Friday night, which meant that choppers full of soldiers had been dispatched from distant Schenckfield at least half an hour earlier, and that the Army knew in advance the accident was going to happen. Tearing a crescent roll, Dom said, "If Falkirk and a Dero company flew in and took over security on the quarantine line so soon after the crisis hit, well, it means the Army must have had advance warning."
"But then, why didn't they stop it from happening?" Georgia Monotella asked, as she cut her daughter's serving of turkey into bite-sized pieces.
"Apparently they couldn't stop it," Dom said. "Maybe there's a terrorist attack on the truck, and maybe Army intelligence only got wind of it just before it went down," Ernie said.
"Maybe," Dom said doubtfully.
"But they would have gone public with that kind of story if it happened, so it must have been something else.
Something involving top-secret data of such importance that only Dero troops could be trusted to keep quiet about it. Brendan Cronin had a heartier appetite than anyone at the table, but his temporal appetite did not diminish the spiritual air that had surrounded him. He swallowed some baked corn and said,
"This explains why there weren't hundreds of people on those 10 miles of interstate when the thing happened, as there should have been at that hour. If the army sealed it off ahead of the event, they had time to get most traffic out of the danger zone before anything actually happened."
Dom said, "Some didn't get out, saw too much, and were held and brainwashed with the rest of us who were already here at the motel."
For a while, everyone joined in the discussion and arrived at all the same theories and unanswerable questions that had occurred to Dom and Ginger at the newspaper offices earlier in the day. Finally, Dom told them about the important discovery he and Ginger had made when, as an afterthought, they had looked through issues of the Sentinel published during the weeks following the toxic spill. When they had finished poring through editions for the week of the crisis, Ginger had suggested that clues to the secret of what really happened on the closed highway that night might be hidden in other news, in unusual stories that appeared to have nothing to do with the crisis but were in fact related to it. They pulled more issues from the files, and by studying every story from a paranoid perspective, they soon found what they hoped for. One place in particular figured in the news in such a way that it seemed linked to the closure of I-80.
"Thunder Hill," Dom said. "We believe that's where our trouble came from. Shankfield was just a ruse, a clever misdirection to focus attention away from the real source of the crisis, Thunder Hill."
Fay and Ernie looked up from their plates in surprise, and Fay said,
"Thunder Hill's 10 or 12 miles north-northeast of here in the mountains. The army has an installation up there, too, the Thunder Hill Depository. There are natural limestone caves in those hills where they store copies of service records and a lot of other important files, so they won't lose all copies if military bases in other parts of the country are wiped out in a disaster. Nuclear war, like that."
Ernie said, "The depository was here before Fay and me. 20 years or more. Rumors have it that files and records aren't the only things in storage there. Some believe there's also huge supplies of food, medicines, weapons, ammunition, which makes sense. In case a big war breaks out, the army wouldn't want all its weapons and supplies on ordinary military bases, because those would be the first nuked. They've surely got fallback caches, and I guess Thunder Hill is one of those."
"Then anything might be up there," Georgia Monotella said uneasily.
"Anything," Ned Sarver said.
"Is it possible the place isn't just a storage dump?" Sandy asked. "Could they also maybe be doing some kind of experiments up there?"
"What kind of experiments?" Brendan asked, leaning over to look past Ned, beside whom he was seated. Sandy shrugged.
"Any kind."
"It's possible," Dom said. The same thought had occurred to him.
"But if there wasn't a toxic spill on I-80, if it was something at Thunder Hill that went wrong," Ginger said, "how could it have affected us, more than 10 miles to the south?"
No one could think of an answer. Marcy, who had been preoccupied with her moon collection for most of the evening, and who had said nothing during dinner, put down her fork and piped up with a question of her own.
"Why is it called Thunder Hill?"
"Sweetie," Faye said, "that's one I can answer. Thunder Hill's really one of 4 huge connecting mountain meadows, a long, sloping piece of high pasture land. It's surrounded by a great many high peaks, and during a storm the place acts like a sort of funnel for sound. The Indians named it Thunder Hill hundreds of years ago because thunder echoes between those peaks and rolls down the mountainsides, and it all pours in on that one particular meadow in a most peculiar way, so that it seems as if the roar isn't coming out of the sky, but as if it's coming right up out of the ground around you."
"Wow,"
Marcy said softly. "I'd probably pee my pants."
"Marcy!"
Georgia said, as everyone broke into laughter.
"Well, gee, I probably would,"
the child replied.
You remember when Grandma and Grandpa came over to dinner at our place, and there was a big storm, really big, and some lightning struck the tree in our yard, and there was this boom, and I peed my pants?
Looking around the table at her new extended family, she said,
I was so embarrassed.
Everyone laughed again, and Georgia said,
That was more than 2 years ago. You're a bigger girl now.
To Dom, Ernie said,
You haven't told us yet why Thunder Hill is the place rather than Shankfield. What'd you find in the newspaper?
In the Sentinel for Friday, July 13th, exactly 1 week after the closure of I-80 and 3 days after its reopening, there was a report of two county ranchers, Norval Brust and Jake Dirksen, who were having trouble with the Federal Bureau of Land Management. A disagreement between ranchers and the BLM was not unusual. The government owned half of Nevada, not merely deserts, but a lot of the best grazing land, some of which it leased to cattlemen for their herds. Ranchers were always complaining that the BLM kept too much good land out of use, that the government ought to sell off part of its holdings to private interests, and that leases were too expensive. But Brust and Dirksen had a new complaint. For years, they leased BLM land surrounding a 300-acre army installation, the Thunder Hill Depository. Brust held 800 acres to the west and south, and Dirksen was using over 700 acres on the east side of Thunder Hill. Suddenly, on Saturday morning, July 7th, though 4 years remained on Brust and Dirksen's leases, the BLM took 500 acres from Brust, 300 from Dirksen, and at the request of the Army, those 800 acres were incorporated into the boundaries of the Thunder Hill Depository.
Which just happens to be the very morning after the toxic spill and the closure of I-80,
Fay observed.
Brust and Dirksen showed up Saturday morning to inspect their herds, per their usual routine, Dom said, and both discovered that their livestock had been driven off most of the leased pasture. A temporary barbed wire fence was being thrown into place along the new perimeter at the Thunder Hill Depository.
Having finished dinner, Ginger pushed her plate aside and said,
The BLM simply told Brust and Dirksen it was unilaterally abrogating their leases, without compensation. But they didn't receive an official written notice till the following Wednesday, which is extremely unusual. Ordinarily, a notice of termination comes 60 days in advance.
Was that kind of treatment legal? Brendan Cronin asked.
Right there's the problem of doing business with the government, Ernie told the priest. You're dealing with the very people who decide what's legal and what isn't. It's like playing poker with God.
Fay said, The BLM's despised around these parts. No bunch of bureaucrats is more high-handed.
That's what we gathered from reading the Sentinel, Dom said. Now, Ginger and I might have figured the Thunder Hill business was just coincidental, that the BLM just happened to go after that land the same time as the crisis on I-80. But the way the government dealt with Brust and Dirksen after the land was seized was so extraordinary it made us suspicious. When the ranchers hired attorneys, when stories about the cancellation of their leases began appearing in the Sentinel, the BLM did a sudden about-face and offered compensation after all.
That's not a bit like the BLM, Ernie said. They'll always make you drag them into court, hoping litigation will wear you down.
How much were they willing to pay Brust and Dirksen? Fay asked.
The figure wasn't revealed, Ginger said. But it was evidently darned good, because Brust and Dirksen accepted it overnight. So the BLM bought their silence, Georgia said.
I think it was the Army working secretly through the BLM, Dom said. They realized the longer the story was in the news, the more chance there was of someone wondering about a link between the crisis on I-80 that Friday night and the unorthodox seizure of land the very next morning, even if the two events were 10 or 12 miles apart.
Surprises me somebody didn't make the connection, Georgia said.
If you and Ginger could spot it this long after the fact, why didn't anyone think of it then?
For one thing, Ginger said, Dom and I had the enormous benefit of hindsight. We know there was a lot more going on during the days of the crisis than anyone suspected at the time, so we were specifically looking for connections. But that July, All the hoopla about a toxic spill diverted attention from Thunder Hill. Furthermore, there was nothing extraordinary about ranchers fighting the BLM, so nothing in the situation linked it in anyone's mind with the I-80 quarantine. In fact, when the BLM made that totally out-of-character offer to Bruston Dirksen, a Sentinel editorial praised the repentant attitude of the government and prophesied a new age of reason.
"But from what you've told us," Dom said to Faye and Ernie, "and from what else we've read, that was the first and last time the Bureau of Land Management dealt reasonably with ranchers. So it wasn't a new policy, just a one-time response to a crisis. And it's too coincidental to believe that the crisis evolving at Thunder Hill was unrelated to the crisis simultaneously underway here along the interstate."
"Besides," Ginger said, "once our suspicion was aroused, we got to thinking that if the trouble that night had been related to Schenckfield, there'd have been no need for the Army to use Dero troops for security, because the soldiers stationed at Schenckfield would already have full security clearances in all matters related to that base, and there would have been nothing about a Schenckfield crisis too sensitive for them to see. The only reason Dero would have been called in is if the crisis was utterly unrelated to Schenckfield, involving something the soldiers at that base were not cleared for."
"So, if there are answers to our problems," Brendan said, "we'll most likely find them at the Thunder Hill Depository."
"We already suspected the story about a spill was less than half true," Dom said. "Maybe there was no truth to it at all. Maybe the crisis had nothing to do with Schenckfield. If the real source was Thunder Hill, the rest was just smoke they blew in the public's eyes."
"It sure feels right," Ernie said.
He had finished dinner, too. His silverware was neatly arranged on the plate, which was almost as clean as before dinner, evidence that his military discipline and order had not departed him.
"You know, part of my service career was in Marine Intelligence, so I'm speaking with some experience when I say this Schenckfield stuff truly does smack of an elaborate cover story."
Ned's frown exaggerated his pronounced widow's peak.
"There are a couple of things I don't understand. The quarantine didn't extend from Thunder Hill all the way down here. There were miles of territory in between that weren't sealed off, so how did the effects of an accident on Thunder Hill leapfrog over all that distance and come down on our heads without causing trouble between there and here?"
"You're not dull-witted," Dom said. "I can't explain it either." Still frowning, Ned said,
"Another thing. The depository doesn't need a lot of land, does it? From what I've heard, it's underground. They got a couple of big blast doors in the side of the hill, a row leading up to the doors, maybe a guard post, and that's it. The 300 acres you mentioned, the area around the entrance is plenty big enough for a security zone. So why the land grab?"
Dom shrugged.
"Beats me.
But whatever the hell happened up there on July 6th, it prompted two emergency actions on the part of the Army. First, a temporary quarantine down here, 10 or 12 miles away, until we witnesses could be dealt with. Second, an immediate enlargement of the security zone around the depository up there in the mountains, a secondary quarantine that's still in effect. I have a hunch, if we're ever going to find out what happened to us, what's still happening, we're going to have to dig into the activities up on Thunder Hill." They were all silent. Though everyone was finished with dinner, no one was ready for dessert. Marcy was using her spoon to draw circles in the greasy residue of turkey gravy on her plate, creating fluid and temporary moon forms. No one moved to clear away the dirty dishes, for at this point in the discussion, no one wanted to miss a word. They were at the crux of their dilemma. How were they to move against enemies as mighty as the U.S. government and army? How were they to penetrate an iron wall of secrecy that had been forged in the name of national security, with the full power of the state and the law behind it?
"We've put together enough to go public," Georgia Monotella said. "The deaths of Zebediah Lomac and Allen, the murder of Pablo Jackson, the similar nightmares that many of you have shared, the Polaroids.
It's the kind of sensational stuff the media thrives on. If we let the world know what we think happened to us, we'll have the power of the press and public opinion on our side. We won't be alone.
Nugget, Ernie said. That kind of pressure will just make the military stonewall like hell. They'll construct an even more confusing and impenetrable cover-up. They don't crack under pressure the way politicians do. On the other hand, as long as they see us stumbling around on our own, fumbling for explanations, they'll be confident, which might give us time to probe for their weak spots.
And don't forget, Ginger warned, apparently Colonel Falkirk advocated killing us instead of just blocking our memories, and we've no reason to believe he's mellowed since then. He was obviously overruled, but if we tried to go public, he might be able to persuade his superiors that a final solution is required after all. But even if it's dangerous, maybe we've got to go public, Sandy said. Maybe George is right. I mean, there's no way we can get inside the Thunder Hill Depository to see what's going on. They've got lots of security and a pair of blast doors built to take a nuclear hit.
Dom said, well, it's like Ernie told us. We'll have to just stay loose and search for their weaknesses until we find a way.
But it looks like they don't have any weaknesses, Sandy said. Their cover-up has been falling apart ever since they brainwashed us and let us go, Ginger said. Each time one of us remembers another detail, that's another gaping hole in their cover-up.
Yeah, Ned said. But seems to me they're in a better position to keep patching the holes than we are to keep poking new ones. Let's can the goddamn negative thinking, Ernie said gruffly.
Smiling beatifically, Brendan Cronin said, he's right. We must not be negative. We need not be negative, because we're meant to win. His voice was again infused with the eerie serenity and certitude which arose from his belief that the revelation of their special fate was inevitable. At moments like this, however, the priest's tone and manner did not comfort Dom, as they were meant to, but, for some odd reason, stirred up a sediment of fear and muddied his emotions with anxiety.
How many men are stationed at Thunder Hill? Georgia asked.
Before Dom or Ginger could respond with information they had gleaned from the sentinel, a stranger appeared in the doorway at the head of the stairs that led up from the motel office. He was in his late 30s, lean and tough-looking, dark-haired, dark-complexioned, with a crooked left eye that was not coordinated with his right. Though the downstairs door was locked, and although the linoleum on the stairs did nothing to quiet ascending footsteps, the intruder appeared with magical silence, as if he were not a real man but an ectoplasmic visitation.
"For God's sake, shut up!"
he said, sounding every bit as real as anyone else in the room.
"If you think you can plot in privacy here, you're badly mistaken."
18 miles southwest of the Tranquility Motel, at Schenckfield Army Testing Grounds, all the buildings, laboratories, administration offices, security command center, cafeteria, recreation lounge, and living quarters, were underground. In the blazing summers on the edge of the high desert, and in the occasionally bitter winters, it was easier and more economical to maintain a comfortable temperature and humidity level in underground rooms than in structures erected on the less-than-hospitable Nevada Barrens. But a more important consideration was the frequent open-air testing of chemical, and occasionally even biological, weapons. The tests were conducted to study the effects of sunlight, wind, and other natural forces on the distribution patterns and potency of those deadly gases, powders, and super-diffusible mists. If the buildings were above ground, any unexpected shift in the wind would contaminate them, making unwilling guinea pigs of base personnel. No matter how involved they became in work or leisure, the staff of Schenckfield never forgot they were beneath the earth, for they had two constant reminders of their condition: the lack of windows, plus the susurration of the piped-in air coming through the wall vents, and the echoing hum of the motors that fanned the air along the pipes. Sitting alone at a metal desk in the office to which he had been temporarily assigned, waiting impatiently and worriedly for the phone to ring, Colonel Leland Falkirk thought,
God, I hate this place.
The never-ending whine and hiss of the air supply system gave him a headache. Since his arrival on Saturday, Falkirk had been eating aspirin as though they were candy. Now he tipped two more out of a small bottle. He poured a glass of ice water from the metal carafe that stood on the desk, but he did not use it to wash down the pills. Instead, he popped the dry aspirin into his mouth and chewed them. The taste was bitter, disgusting, and he almost gagged, but he did not reach for the water. He did not spit out the aspirin, either. He persevered. A lonely, miserable childhood, filled with uncertainty and pain, followed by an even worse adolescence, had taught Leland Falkirk that life was hard, cruel and utterly unjust, that only fools believed in hope or salvation, and that only the tough survived. From an early age, he had forced himself to do things that were emotionally, mentally, and physically painful, for he had decided that self-inflicted pain would toughen him and make him less vulnerable. He tempered the steel of his will with challenges that ranged from chewing dry aspirin to major tests, like the outings that he called desperation survival treks. Those expeditions lasted 2 weeks or longer, and they put him face to face with death. He parachuted into a forest or jungle wilderness far from the nearest outpost, without supplies, with only the clothes on his back. He carried no compass or matches. His only weapons were his bare hands and what he could fashion with them. The goal? Reach civilization, alive. He spent many vacations in that self-imposed suffering, which he judged worthwhile, because he came back a harder and more self-reliant man than he'd been at the start of each adventure. Now he crunched dry aspirin. The tablets were reduced to powder, and the powder turned his saliva to an acidic paste. "Ring, damn you," he said to the telephone on the desk. He was hoping for news that would get him out of this hole in the ground. In Dero, the Domestic Emergency Response Organization, a colonel was less a desk jockey and more a field officer than in any other branch of the Army. Falkirk's home base was in Grand Junction, Colorado, not Schenckfield, but even in Colorado he spent little time in his office. He thrived on the physical demands of the job, so the low-ceilinged, windowless rooms of Schenckfield felt like a many-chambered coffin. If he had been engaged upon any mission but this one, he might have established temporary unit headquarters up at Thunder Hill Depository. That place was also underground, but its caves were huge, high-ceilinged, not like these tomb-sized rooms. But there were two reasons he had to keep his men away from Thunder Hill. First, he dared not draw attention to the place because of the secret it harbored. Several ranchers lived in the highlands along the road leading to the gated Thunder Hill turnoff. If they spotted a fully equipped Dero company moving into the depository, they'd speculate about it. Locals must not start wondering about Thunder Hill. 2 summers ago, he had used Schenckfield as a red herring to divert attention from the depository. Now, with another crisis building, he would stay here at Schenckfield again, so he would be in position to spread the same kind of disinformation